Coming up on Tech News Weekly, first, we talk with Protocol's own Ben Pimentel about California pushing for cryptocurrency regulation by way of Governor Gavin Newsom's new executive order. Then Protocol so lovingly provides another person for us to talk to. This time it's Lizzie Lawrence, who is talking to us about how big tech is responding to Roe v. Wade and the potential decision of the U.S. Supreme Court. Then we talk about how Sonos is getting into the virtual assistant game in a big way, and Jason Howell rounds things out with three really interesting stories of the week. But you're going to have to stay tuned if you want to check those out.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 233, recorded Thursday, May 5th, 2022. This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by ExpressVPN. Using the internet without ExpressVPN is like walking your dog in public without securing them on a leash. For 3 extra months free with a 1-year package, go to expressvpn.com/TNW.
And by IT Pro TV. IT Pro TV has everything you need to level up your IT skills while you enjoy the journey. Visit itpro.tv/TNW for an additional 30% off all consumer subscriptions for the lifetime of your active subscription when you use code TNW30 at checkout.
And by Hover, whether you're a developer, photographer, or small business, Hover has something for you to expand your projects and get the visibility you want. Go to hover.com/twit to get 10% off your first purchase of any domain extension for the entire first year.
Hello and welcome to Tech News Weekly, the show where every week we talk to and about the people making and breaking the tech news. And we are making and breaking the making and the breaking of the tech news from our respective locations today.
That's right. At home. I'm Al, you're Micah Sargent, and we are at home this week. You know, we like to keep you on your feet, keep you on your toes. Uh-huh.
Keep you on your toes and make sure that you're always paying attention. All right, folks, let's get into the show today. We're going to kick things off with a conversation about probably one of my least favorite subjects, but I love that there is attention being paid to one of my least favorite subjects because it means that folks that exist in the crypto space need to be paying attention to the way that they're playing around with this funny money. Joining us to talk about California's new, attention being paid to crypto is Ben Pimentel from Protocol. Welcome back to the show, Ben.
Thanks, Mike. I thought you were going to say California is your least favorite subject.
that's only second. No, I kid. So let's dig into this first with Web3, with crypto, with all of these buzzwords. I think that it is unlikely that somebody who's watching the show hasn't at least heard of these things. But I thought it would be a good idea to kind of kick things off with the sort of regulational focus that is taking place right now. Can you tell us kind of when, for example, in your headline, you say California is pushing for its own transparent crypto regulations. When we say crypto regulations, is this cryptocurrency on its own? Is this cryptocurrency and these things we hear about called NFT, the blockchain? Can you give us a basic sort of scope for these regulations?
Sure thing. So what happened was California Governor Gavin Newsom issued an executive order focused on crypto, which sort of sets the tone for how to regulate not just the currency, but it's actually the technology. I mean, like you said, crypto, which sort of took off around 2009 when Bitcoin was released, and has now really expanded into a, as of this morning, $1.7 trillion markets, very volatile. And there's a lot of concern about where it's headed. At the same time, a lot of people are excited about the technology. And of course, California plays an important role in this space. This is with the home of Coinbase and Ripple and other technology companies focus in this space. And so it's sort of underlines the heightened interest and emphasis on Bitcoin and blockchain. And you mentioned NFTs, which basically just exploded last year in terms of as an important segment of this market.
Mm-hmm. So with all of this sort of having more attention paid to it, we've seen quite a few of these attempts to sort of scam the system, to try to earn money that maybe a person should not have been earning. We saw some different folks. In fact, there was just recently a story about a couple who were able to pull a bunch of money in cryptocurrency out from under many different people. And then they were able to launder this cryptocurrency through a bunch of different methods and almost got away with it, but they did get tracked down. I'm curious if we could talk a little bit more about this executive order in particular and whether or not this is a focus more on sort of laying a base, or is this a response to the potential financial loss that can take place with cryptocurrency, the fact that this crypto space is ripe for abuse, and maybe it's a little bit of both. Maybe it is laying a base. Maybe it's also a response to this. I'm curious about your thoughts on that.
It's both. It's the short answer. It's both. I mean, it's an important technology. It's an important trend. It's growing. It's not just the United States. It's global now. And there is a worry that the U.S. should play an important role in leading that trend. I mean, the U.S. is leading that role, but that leading that trend. But there's also some pushback on what you said exactly. There's concern about the use of crypto and blockchain in illicit activity, including money laundering. There's still a lot of hacks going on and a lot of concern about the use of crypto for criminal activities. But even beyond that, there's also growing worries about the impact of crypto on investors and consumers. Because, I think it was last week when Fidelity announced that they're now going to be accepting Bitcoin. For retirement funds. And that's worrisome for some people because the view is that if you're going to be messing around with people's money, you're going to be enticing them to invest in this, you have to be disclosing a lot of information. That's sort of the thrust of the SEC now and other regulators because consumers need to know what's behind this, in the same way that when you invest in publicly traded companies, You will get reports constantly. They are required to let you know how the business is going and what problems are arising. And that's sort of the focus now of some of the regulatory initiatives. But at the same time, there is also a worry that the U.S. will fall behind if there's too much regulation. Mm-hmm. If there are people who are saying, hey, we should stop this, because the rest of the world is running with this technology.
Okay, so what all is involved in Governor Gavin Newsom's executive order in particular? Now that we can kind of dig into this, what does this executive order hope to achieve?
I mean, it's basically much echoes a lot of what the Biden executive order on crypto, which came out last March, has already said. I mean, it's sort of just reaffirms the view that this is an important technology, so there should be more research, there should be more conversation between regulators and the crypto companies, while at the same time also focusing on making sure that it doesn't turn into a trend that leads to instability in the financial system, and that there are enough safeguards when it comes to security. The hacks are still a problem because of the decentralized nature of blockchain and cryptocurrencies. So it's becoming a major problem when it comes to law enforcement and even national security. Even the Ukraine war now has become part of the issue, because there've been a lot of we heard about the sanctions against the allies of Vladimir Putin, right? And the fear has been, and there's the debate on whether these oligarchs and the Russian government itself can use crypto and Bitcoin to bypass those sanctions. So it's both sides of the equation in terms of making sure that crypto innovation continues, that the U.S. it plays an important role in that, while at the same time making sure that it doesn't lead to the problems that a technology that's not regulated leads to.
Understood. So let's talk about kind of the reaction, because I have to think that just like big tech, anytime you hear about these lawmakers moving to regulate big tech, then Apple, Facebook, Google all sort of kick up their people that talk to lawmakers and also kick up the people that talk to the general public and start putting out, you know, stories about how the latest regulation is going to ruin everything and everyone's going to never be able to use their devices again, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Have you been paying attention at all to the reaction to Governor Gavin Newsom's new executive order? Do we know kind of how people are responding to this, what the crypto folks are thinking about this? Is this a moment of excitement and joy for them because it's a further sort of substantiation of the, or rather a further encouragement of the validity of crypto? Or are they going, oh no, don't tread on our crypto?
I mean, the reaction has been basically similar to the reaction to the Biden order, which is the crypto industry welcomed it. They cheered it because it wasn't, because Biden, the president, affirmed the importance of blockchain and crypto and the need for the U.S. to be at the forefront of those developments, while at the same time reaffirming too and stating that there is a need to be careful in terms of how these technologies are regulated to make sure that you know, consumers are not harmed and businesses are not, and especially investors are not harmed in this development. And in a way, California, you know, because of its critical role, is sort of just reaffirming those two things in terms mm-hmm. of the importance of blockchain and crypto, while at the same time making sure that there are rules in place to make sure that it doesn't cause any harm to the financial system and to society.
Understood. Yeah. And this is hardly the only kind of, as you mentioned in your article, California is kind of a, of course, it's technology is plays a big role here, but particularly we've seen a lot of financial technology stuff really ramping up. It was just what Stripe that announced a platform for being able to interface with different banking systems, which is a lot like Plaid. And that, of course, is you know, one example of several. And so sort of figuring out how to get all of these things to work together. You mentioned that California has that Office of Financial Technology and Innovation, yes. and that they, you know, are paying attention to all of this. What does this executive order also lay the ground rules for the sort of taxation of cryptocurrency? Because I don't know about you, but just in anecdotally speaking, I saw a number of people, some who were saying, oh my goodness, I'm really annoyed that I had cryptocurrency at all because it was so confusing trying to fill that out for my taxes at the end of the year. And then there was one story where a person had said that their accountant asked them if they had any cryptocurrency. When they said no, their accountant was like, oh, thank God. So does this lay the groundwork for that? Or is this kind of the jumping off point and more to do with taxes will come later on?
That's a big issue. I think on the national level, there was the infrastructure bill was passed last year last year. And there's a provision there that contains that focuses on taxing people who are involved in the blockchain ecosystem, which the industry is pushing back against because it sort of, you know, if you're a software developer, you technically, or you know, the suggestion of the language is that you could be taxed. But there, it goes beyond a lot of these issues, I believe. I mean, there are different states that are already taking their own initiative in terms of how they approach crypto and blockchain, for instance. You know, Wyoming, there's a push to let people pay their taxes in Bitcoin and crypto. And there's even in states like Arizona and Texas to make Bitcoin legal tender. There have been proposals like that. And of course, internationally, it's already legal tender in El Salvador. So there are all these developments, and I think California rightfully is responding, because a lot of these debates, I think, and most of the experts I talked to, will be settled at the national level. It'll have to be Washington, it'll have to be Congress to come up with the rules related to this. But the states definitely will play a critical role in terms of maybe providing guidance, providing suggestions in terms of how it should be approached. Well, and I know what you're saying about taxes and Bitcoin, because I see that my friends get confused every time tax time comes around.
Yeah, absolutely. Ben, I want to thank you so much for taking some time out of your day and helping us kind of crawl through all of this and explain it a little bit more. It's always a joy to have you on. Of course, folks can head to protocol.com to check out your work. But if they want to follow you online, where should they go to do that?
I'm on Twitter at Ben P. Mintel, and of course, protocol.com is our main site. And I also have a Google Voice number they can reach me at, or reach me by email, bpmintel@protocol.com.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks, Micah.
All right. Thank you, Ben. All right. Up next, how the bombshell leak of the Supreme Court draft opinion, Roe versus Wade, how that's intersecting with big tech. We're going to talk about that up next. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by ExpressVPN. ExpressVPN is the VPN that I use. I love it. It's so useful. It's so easy. That's the thing that I love most about it. Using the internet without ExpressVPN, it's kind of like walking your dog in public without putting that dog on a leash. Most of the time, you're probably going to be fine. But, you know, what if there's that one day where your dog runs away or gets dognapped or whatever it may be? It's better to be careful, right? Especially when it's as simple as something like ExpressVPN. Every time you connect to that unencrypted network, wherever you happen to be, in cafes, hotels, airports, wherever it happens to be, your online data is not secured. It's unencrypted, so it's unprotected. Any hacker on the same network can gain access to and steal your personal data potentially. But ExpressVPN actually creates a secure encrypted tunnel between your device and the internet so that they can't do that. It'd take a hacker with a supercomputer over a billion years to get past ExpressVPN's encryption. ExpressVPN works on all of your devices. So that's not just your smartphone. It's also your laptop, your tablet, even on your smart TV. And it's so easy to use. Literally, you know, it's one of the things I love most about it, because I've used VPNs that were really complicated in the past. You just fire up the app, click the one button that you're given, and you're instantly protected. And it doesn't slow things down. That's another thing I love about ExpressVPN, especially, you know, if you're using it to, you know, watch content on Netflix in a different location. You think, oh, well, this is going to, you know, ramp down the resolution of what I'm watching, because, you know, the internet connectivity is going to be slower and you know, more latency and that stuff. You don't get that with ExpressVPN. It really is the best of all worlds. All right. So what are you waiting for? Get an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN free at ExpressVPN.com/TNW. That's ExpressVPN.com/TNW. Check it out. You're going to love it just like I do. ExpressVPN.com/TNW. And we thank them for their support of Tech News Weekly. All right. So this has been a really challenging week. And I will fully admit it's been really emotional for many people, myself included. Very grim week. Supreme Court draft opinion that leaked that shows that Roe versus Wade was likely to be overturned in the coming months, and the impact that that has on women's health. I mean, it's crazy what's going on right now. That action has actually sent tech companies on a path to understanding exactly how such an unprecedented undoing of law might impact the health of its female employees. And joining us to talk about this, this complicated and tumultuous, it's probably the right word for it, turn of events, is Lizzie Lawrence from Protocol. Welcome to the show, Lizzie.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. Happy to get you on. Though I wish it were different circumstances, but here we are, and I think it's really important to shine a light on all facets of this as we continue on into the coming months. And the tech side, it's easy to think that this is, you know, this has nothing to do with tech, but actually there are a lot of angles with that technology intersects with exactly what's going on right now. And first of all, you wrote that this actually isn't the first time that tech companies have had to look into, you know, things like abortion rights. This began in Texas last September. Talk a little bit about kind of how tech companies have made changes as a result of that Texas ban on abortions last year.
Yeah. So Texas's abortion ban was a huge deal in tech, particularly because throughout the pandemic, it was hailed as this new oasis for tech companies, right? And companies like Oracle and Hewlett Packard Enterprise moved their headquarters to the state. So then once these companies were there, you know, a lot of companies with significant presences had to grapple with having employees in a state with severely restricted reproductive care. So a lot of companies did stay quiet on this. My colleague Issy Lepowski wrote an excellent piece about the Texas abortion ban in particular. And as I recall, she didn't get a lot of direct answers, but there were some companies that were pretty vocal immediately, like Match Group and Bumble. Pretty quickly set up funds for employees and dependents who needed to seek care outside of Texas. And Mark Benioff of Salesforce also tweeted out his support for employees and, you know, promised to help them relocate if the state, after the state passed its restrictive abortion law. So that was definitely that was an aspect that was important. And then the other kind of way that tech companies were really implicated with the Texas abortion law is that aiding and abetting clause, which said, you know, anyone can be knowingly or unknowingly, anyone can be sued for knowingly or unknowingly helping someone get an abortion. So that could affect rideshare drivers. That could affect platforms like Facebook or Google, you know, being forced to comply with subpoenas in abortion cases. So Lyft and Uber did pledge publicly to cover drivers' legal expenses in Texas and Oklahoma. The major tech platforms have not really spoken out yet about what they'll do.
Right. And what they'll do, I mean, facing, you know, everything that's coming, that was a very, you know, in that situation, very specifically kind of located to the state of Texas. Now we're looking at, you know, all the states in one way or another being shaped and affected by this in the next couple of months. So a broader, if not complete, strike down of Roe versus Wade is kind of on the table, if not assured. I mean, you know, some people feel like there's a possibility of unwinding that, but I don't know that I'm all too optimistic about that. What kind of direct impact might this have on tech companies, and in particular, big tech companies, when we're thinking about, you know, them as being the ones who haven't really acted on this yet? Like, how, if you had to guess, or if there are any clues, what does that tell you?
Yeah, so there are a couple things I think about here, and I think about tech's responsibility to its users and to its employees. And in terms of users, kind of the aiding and abetting clause that I spoke about mentions, you know, hints at some of the larger legal and surveillance issues and how much messier this becomes when it's, yeah, like you said, not just a few states, but potentially half the country. So, I mean, tech companies are going to, big tech companies are going to have to decide, you know, a lot of them really do tend to comply with, you know, valid legal demands of valid legal subpoenas. So they'll, you know, as these cases roll in, you know, I know it's a draft opinion, so I don't want to get ahead of myself. As these cases roll in, you know, they'll have to decide how much they'll disclose and how much they'll protect users. And I mean, and then the other thing, you know, on the employee side is they'll have to decide how to best support their employees living in these states and whether they'll expand employee health care. And, you know, or potentially relocate employees. So lately, like a growing number of tech companies have decided to expand coverage by reimbursing employees for abortion related travel. So Yelp announced that it would do this, and Citigroup and Apple and Match Group and Bumble also have similar policies. But yeah, it's definitely going to become messier as this, if this, you know, if Roe's overturned and it impacts half the country.
Sure. I mean, there's going to be, you know, from the company's side, they're going to be forced into a position or placing themselves willingly into a position where they're taking a side on this. And that in turn has the potential of, you know, putting them in the face of legal risk potentially by supporting or protecting employees who travel for an abortion, as one example. What about the employees themselves? Because, you know, and you point this out in your piece, but it was kind of something that I hadn't considered until I read it. And then I was like, oh yeah, that's actually a really big deal. Finding yourself in a position to seek out an abortion is a very, like, an incredibly private decision. However, when the lines start to get blurred between what a person chooses for themselves and what a person has to, like, rely on their company and the company's support and benefits in order to, you know, to move towards, like, some people just aren't going to feel comfortable doing that. Sounds like it's a pretty tricky scenario. What are your thoughts on that?
Absolutely. That's a huge issue. And I mean, it shows some of the problems that arise when our health is so tightly linked with our employers and when these, you know, decisions on abortion and other healthcare issues are, you know, kicked from the national level to really become corporations' responsibilities. So, you know, and abortion in particular is so stigmatized. People are starting to, you know, slowly come out and talk. People who've received abortions are starting to talk about that. Musician, you know, Phoebe Bridgers tweeted about it, her experience a few days ago, and a cohort of Congress people have kind of spoken out about it too. But it's definitely hard to talk about it, and it's not something you might want to yet disclose to your boss or, you know, file a reimbursement claim for. So that's where the importance of company culture and speaking out comes in. I mean, some companies are not, you know, going to be willing or unwilling to weigh in on abortion. Like Hewlett Packard explicitly told me that they don't take a position on it, though they will, they do cover the procedure out of state or for employees who need to travel to get it, abortions out of state. But if you're a company that does want to expand abortion access for your employees, you really might want to consider being more vocal about your desire for that and, you know, emphasize, be transparent then and emphasize that this is not something that, this is something that will, you know, is handled sensitively, that, you know, you won't, there'll be no judgment or stigma around, that really the company does want to provide abortion, help employees get abortion care with no, you know, criteria or qualifications. Just being upfront about that.
Yeah. I think that's wise. Now, we've seen in the last couple of years, you know, thanks in no small part to COVID, this like ever kind of shifting, some might say evolving attitude around work from home. Companies, you know, definitely a couple of years ago that may not have felt very positively about letting their employees work full time from home are now considering that. There's kind of a change happening. Some companies are holding steadfast, you know, to coming into the office, but other companies are broadening that out, like Airbnb, for example. And it occurs to me that some employers might best actually protect their employees by not requiring them to live and to work in a state that isn't hospitable to women's reproductive rights. So what are your thoughts there? Do you think this could actually act to further broaden work from home policies? Like that could be one kind of tool in the toolbox for companies to provide support for employees in this way?
Definitely. I think that's one of the easiest things employers can do is, you know, offer to relocate employees or really, you know, yeah, get rid of requirements, making employees stay in a certain state. And a lot of these big tech companies are, you know, the work is more flexible and not tied to, you know, a factory or, you know, in-person work. So it is really plausible for them to allow their employees freedom of movement. And I think, you know, there's been a lot of conversation about recruitment and retention and, you know, working from home is really just table stakes at this point for a lot of these tech companies and for candidates. So, you know, definitely implementing this, especially in the context of, you know, the draft opinion and Roe possibly being overturned, if you want, you know, particularly for companies who want to diversify their workforce or who really prioritize workplace equity, you know, candidates might not want to work for companies that don't make up for this gap in healthcare, or they might not want to work in states with laws that limit their reproductive freedoms or other kinds of freedoms or laws they fundamentally don't believe in. So, I think, you know, that is a route that a lot of companies have already taken and will continue to take.
Yeah, I'm not surprised to hear that. And then finally, you didn't write this article, but your colleague Ben Brody wrote about the privacy implications facing tech companies in light of abortion eventually becoming illegal, potentially here in the U.S. And, you know, we have Texas as the example to look towards, you know, as far as like what that might look like. Just a couple of days ago, you know, there was the news about SafeGraph and the sharing of information there of women seeking abortions and kind of the impact of that, you know, and the potential impact on a broader scale. What are your thoughts there as far as around these privacy implications and what that might look like as we head forward into the coming months?
Yeah. So, I mean, we already know that our online activity is meticulously tracked and in many cases, most cases monetized. But this just throws that into sharper relief and shows, you know, some of the very real world serious implications that has. So, yeah, I mean, SafeGraph, I think there was another, story or reporters talking about another kind of data broker today that is, you know, has just a plethora or, you know, a plethora of information on people visiting family planning clinics and abortion clinics. And there is really with, you know, an aiding and abetting clauses and laws, there will really be a market for that and people who are looking for that information. So Ben, yeah, my colleague Ben wrote about the importance of digital hygiene, for people, you know, individuals seeking, abortion care, and using the internet to do that and how it'll be really important to, using crypto platforms or, you know, incorporate ad blockers. But it's tough because, I mean, it'll be really interesting to see because, you know, I saw people pointed this out, but, we haven't lived in an internet post Roe world. Like this was, you know, 1973, the internet was not a thing in the way it is now. So it will be, scary and enlightening to see how, you know, how people use the internet to get information out, but then how people also weaponize it and are able to, you know, how companies or data brokers will be, you know, what platforms will be, what information they'll be forced to, or might choose to, provide in, you know, court cases concerning abortion. So I think, There's a lot of rightful concerns about what privacy and digital surveillance will look like in a post-Roe world.
100%. Well, Lizzie, really appreciate you taking time to join us to talk about this incredibly important issue. Lizzie Lawrence, of course, writes for protocol.com. If folks want to find this article, of course, they can go to Protocol. But if they want to find you online and follow the work you're doing, where can they find you?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter at @LizzieLaw_, and my email is llawrence@protocol.com. And I'm also on LinkedIn. So reach out to me in any of those ways.
Excellent. Thank you. Keep up the great work, Lizzie. We appreciate your time. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you so much.
All right. Take care. All right. Oh, no, actually, it's over to Micah. Sorry.
Yeah. Hi there. Hi. Up next. Hello. Hi. Hello. Up next, we've got a new virtual assistant entering the ring. We'll talk about that in a second. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by IT Pro TV. It is important when looking for an online IT training platform that you are getting the most up-to-date content and certifications. So I'm going to make it super easy for you. Ready? Go to IT Pro TV. Did you expect that? You should have, because that is the duh answer. In fact, IT Pro TV just released a new course, CompTIA A+ Core 1 and Core 2 Series. This course is designed for professionals who support today's core technologies from security to networking to virtualization and more. CompTIA's A+ certification is an industry standard for launching IT careers in today's digital world. In this course, you'll learn about hardware, operating systems, networking, security, and troubleshooting. We talk about how great IT Pro TV is, but here's a reminder why it's so great. It's because they have 7 studios where they are constantly filming Monday through Friday. So that means you're going to get new content all the time. Their courses go from the studio that they're filming in Monday through Friday to their course library in 24 hours, and they're divided into 20 to 30-minute episodes so that you can easily go through them. They make sure you're prepared for your exams with their virtual labs and practice tests. The best part about IT Pro TV is that you can learn and get certified on your own schedule, and it is always entertaining. May is ramping up for summer, and so is IT Pro TV. Their free Azure weekend is scheduled for May 14th and 15th. You can head to their website to get free courses and a great introduction to your next IT career. IT Pro TV will have two free webinars this month for you to check out. May 5th at 2 p.m. EST. It's called What is Azure Bicep? It has nothing to do with my very tiny biceps. This is with Adam Gordon and Wes Bryan, May 19th at 2 p.m. EST. Oh, by the way, it's May 5th, so I can go learn about that Azure bicep if I want to. But May 19th at 2 p.m. EST, all things cybersecurity with Daniel Lowry and John Hammond. Don't forget, by the way, about your IT team. Check out an IT Pro TV business plan for your team today. Visit itpro.tv/TNW for an additional 30% off all consumer subscriptions for the lifetime of your active subscription when you use the code TNW30. That's itpro.tv/TNW and use the code TNW30 for an additional 30% off for the lifetime of your active subscription. IT Pro TV, build or expand your IT career and enjoy the journey. Thanks so much to IT Pro TV for sponsoring this week's episode of Tech News Weekly. All right. My story of the week is about Sonos. So Sonos is well known for its audio systems. It's got a bunch of different speakers. It was one of the first companies to figure out kind of wireless audio streaming in a way that would let you sync audio between rooms, but also could do so in a way where you weren't losing a whole bunch of quality to that audio. So Sonos, first of all, kicked that off quite well. But it appears that the company is kind of paying attention to what it might want to do in the future to sort of diversify. We hear this a lot from different companies. Apple, for the longest, has been able to rely on the iPhone as this device that kind of completely provided for the entire company. It continues to be a huge moneymaker for it, but at some point you reach iPhone saturation. You reach a point when everybody who wants to have one has one. And so you're only getting people who are getting upgrades from time to time. So the company said, what do we do about that? We need to diversify. We need to think about other things. And the way that they did that was by going into services. The idea that you would have these recurring subscriptions for content or features that you could have. Amazon is well known for its Amazon Prime subscription service. That is one of its opportunities for making money. And so all of these companies are kind of looking for their own. Sonos, given that it's a hardware company, you know, it kind of had this, okay, we sell you this thing and then that's the end of it. So they introduced the Sonos Radio HD service and the Sonos Radio service, which are its own take on streaming media that provides a recurring cost so that they're getting some money off of not just the hardware that people buy from time to time or buy once and then don't buy again because the Sonoses are made so well. And now is the opportunity for them to make that money. So how do they go from there? Well, we've heard from Patrick Spence, who is Sonos' chief executive officer, who said that, you know, we're paying attention to different things. One of those things could become video, as the company is working on. It hasn't yet been announced, but has been seen kind of in different places, called Home Theater OS, an operating system for your home theater. So we could eventually see a soundbar, for example, from Sonos that is also a device on which you can stream content. So it's got, you know, your Netflix apps and all that kind of stuff. But the most recent news is that Sonos is about to introduce its own virtual assistant. This is reportedly coming out on June 1st. And this is Sonos's own take on voice functionality. Now, what's interesting is Sonos is... there's this idea that you can make a virtual assistant and you want it to do as much as possible, right? It can talk to your reminders app. It can order you a coffee. It can get you an Uber. It can look up maps. It can provide jokes. It can add. It can subtract. Da 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 da. And with that comes a whole lot of sort of edge cases where the virtual assistant doesn't work. This is where Sonos is being clever, because they are making a virtual assistant, at least kicking it off, that is very good at the one thing it needs to do well, and that is music control. And so the folks who have talked about this, of course not supposed to be saying anything, but the people familiar with the company's plans have shown that this technology, this Sonos voice control, is a lot quicker than competing assistants are at being able to perform what they call core music tasks. So play, pause, play music that I would like, play a soundtrack for dancing, play a soundtrack for a breakup, that kind of thing, where it may take a little bit longer for one of the other virtual assistants to respond and provide what you need. Sonos is coming out with the assistant that can do that. Sonos is supposed to be having a wake word or a wake phrase, "Hey Sonos." And what also makes Sonos unique is that it is going to include some sort of chip or chipset that will make all of this processing happen locally. Nothing will be sent away to the cloud. Google and Amazon, it was Apple first, then Google, then Amazon, if I remember correctly, who eventually added some on-device voice processing features, where even if you were disconnected from the internet, the on-device chip would be able to answer some commands or respond to some commands and answer some of the questions that you had, rather than having to send them off to the server where they could be processed and can then tell the virtual assistant what you're actually trying to ask in its language. Apple does as much of it as it can locally on your device. Google and Amazon do some of it, but not a whole lot of it locally on your device. And Amazon, I think, continues to be kind of the one that more than anything kicks it away to its servers to do as much of that processing. So in that way, Sonos can set itself apart from these by saying, Apple talks about privacy. You don't know privacy until you've used the Sonos speakers new voice control. Because with us, you can have this thing completely disconnected from the wide area network, just on your local area network, and still be able to control your music entirely. That, I think, is a really good value prop for Sonos's own voice assistant, or Sonos voice control, as it's called. And what's interesting is, as it stands, it seems that the Verge reports that Sonos is going to, this voice system will work with Apple Music, Amazon Music, Pandora, Deezer, and the company's own Sonos Radio. Google's YouTube Music and Spotify, nowhere to be found yet. A little interesting that Spotify is not on that list, given how Spotify loves to talk about every other company's antitrust issues and how that should be an open market and this and that and the other. And Spotify is always at the heart of every different, seems like every different antitrust lawsuit. Yet they are not on this and not part of this group of music control for Sonos voice. And then what's secondarily interesting is that as it stands, it seems like Sonos is going to be able to be used in concert with Amazon's own Alexa. So that would mean that you can say, "Hey Sonos," or you can say Alexa, and have those things happen. What that means, as The Verge points out, is that someone who is all in on the Echo ecosystem, on the Echo ecosystem, will not have to give up the commands and the sort of experience that they're used to, but can still step into that much improved experience of the Sonos audio that you get with that. So all of this is very fascinating. I'm looking forward to June 1st to seeing how this goes, what the Sonos voice control is like, how much it can actually do versus the other smart assistants, and then how these companies will or will not choose to integrate with the next version. Because Google is well known for in the past saying because Sonos at one point was trying to do a feature on its operating system where you could use the Google Assistant, you could use Siri, and you could use Amazon's assistant, Alexa, all together. And Google said, absolutely not. There is no way that we will allow you to use the Google Assistant and the Amazon virtual assistant at the same time. There can be a toggle where you get to choose one or the other, but there's no way that we're going to let you let users be able to address both of those virtual assistants on one device. And Sonos said, we can do that though. Like you don't need to worry about it. We can figure out the technology. And Google said, no. So I'm curious to see how the company will respond if in this way it is Sonos's own voice assistant, but potentially running in concert with Amazon. Does that mean that Google will never allow its YouTube Music service on board? We'll have to see how that goes. Oh, and that's also paired with how, although the companies still work together in other ways with your Sonos devices right now, you can listen to Google's YouTube Music. Sonos is also responsible for Google having to roll back some of its features that it had for its own, what are those called? Not Google Play, but Chromecast audio devices, where you used to be able to do some multi-room audio playback and volume control features. And you would have these controls, and Google had to kind of take a few of those away because of a lawsuit with Sonos. So it's interesting how the companies continue to work together, sort of, but it's sort of a begrudging thing.
Of course.
I assume if you do talk to your devices, it's probably Google. Do you have any Sonos speakers, or have you ever used any Sonos speakers?
So throughout the house, we have Google Home speakers, almost every room. And then out in our garage, which during the pandemic got converted into my wife's, basically her office, you know, she kind of created a gym. We created a gym out of it. So from her old office came a Sonos system. So we have a Sonos system here. I don't really interact with it very much. It's kind of part of what drives her gym, her work. And, you know, and it's nice, but I think what will be interesting to me is when I think of Google Home's, you know, assistant functionality, when I think of, you know, what's driving Apple Siri, you know, the smart, smart voice control there. And I think of Amazon with, Alexa, I think of like full service voice control, like not just a focused single use, like this is designed for this particular one thing to do it really well. It's like, we do everything. You want to know, you know, the definition of blah, 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 or how to spell so-and-so, or, you know, any number of random things you can get creative with on those systems, you can do that. It kind of sounds like the Sonos system being all on device and being focused on music will probably have a much more limited use case as a result. And I'm not saying that to say that it's bad. I actually think that's probably smart for Sonos to do and not try and reinvent the wheel and do everything to everyone. So I wonder if some of these like compatibility issues between services won't be as much of a deal because Sonos isn't really competing with a Google or an Amazon on doing everything. It's just offering a solution to perhaps control sound on its devices in a more, you know, in a better way by comparison to the kind of you know, the basic, for lack of a better word, but the all, you know, the all inclusive, let's say, control schemes that maybe a Google Home or an Echo or whatever other device does. On Sonos, they know what they need to do on their device. They know what they need to do well, and they have some ideas on how to make the music listening experience a little bit better than what we're getting out of these devices already. So I'm curious to see what that is. And I wonder if that, because of that, that kind of delineation, because of that focus, it might actually enable them to coexist in an easier way.
Yeah. That's that on that.
All right. Well, that is that on that. And this is this ad that I'm going to read to you next. But before I do, just to let you know, I've got a story of the week coming up. It's actually a trifecta story of the week. I'm doing it a little bit different this week. I had a few stories that I've been holding on to. I was like, these are all cool. So let's talk about them all. I promise it won't be super duper long, but I think they're just three stories that caught my attention this week. So that's coming up next. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Hover. It's time to make plans and to let Hover help you achieve them. Hover's great for that. If you're looking for, you know, a domain name, Hover is the place that I go when I'm looking for a domain name. I love it. If you're a blogger, you're creating a portfolio, you're building an online store, or maybe you just want to make a more memorable redirect to your LinkedIn page, Hover has the best domain names and email addresses just for you. Email at your domain name is actually key when you're connecting with customers. It builds trust for your brand, makes things seem a little less generic and a little more focused on you. They have domain-based emails for all of your needs, small or large, and it's just super easy to set up. You can add as many mailboxes to your domain as you need. When your domain renews, your mailboxes are going to renew too. Pretty awesome. Also, the prices are unbeatable. Their most popular mailbox is a no-brainer solution for business owners. You can get access from anywhere. You can use the email app that you're already comfortable with. And if apps aren't your thing, they have webmail that can be accessed anywhere you happen to be. Like I said, I love Hover. I think it's easy to use, right? Like when I have an idea for a domain name, I go to Hover, I plug it in. The way they make that process is just so simple. It's enjoyable versus some other sites that I've gone to searching for domains. And it feels kind of sterile and just not as enjoyable. I love Hover for that. Hover isn't here to upsell you on stuff you don't need. They just want to help. They have pro-level tools, so they're going to have powerful domain and email management tools that are very intuitive and easy to use, whether you're a web pro or if you happen to just be getting started. They're also private and secure. There's Whois privacy protection included with your domain purchase. So your private information is going to remain just that, private. It's an awesome way to reduce spam, also to protect yourself from unwanted solicitations. And then Hover Connect actually lets you pick the service you want to use to build and host your website. By using Connect, it helps you start using your domain name with just a few clicks. At Hover, you're a customer, you're not a source of data, so you can actually take back control of your data with reliable, tracker-free email. Hover is trusted by hundreds of thousands of customers, myself included, who use their domain names and email to turn their ideas into a reality. So no matter who you are, whether you're a developer, photographer, small business, Hover has something for you to expand your projects and get the visibility you want. Just go to hover.com/twit. You'll get 10% off your first purchase of any domain extension for the entire first year. That's hover.com/twit. Do that. You'll get 10% off your domain extension for a full year. And then it lets them know that you heard about it through Twit. We appreciate that as well. And we thank Hover for their support of Tech News Weekly. So like I said, I'm taking the story of the week and making it plural. So there's three stories that I have on the docket today, starting with this one. We have a lot of water on this planet, right? 70% of the planet is covered in it. I think it's something like 97 or 98% of that water is like ocean water, which means it's salt water, which means you can't drink it. Meanwhile, we've got 3 billion people in this world suffering from lack of access to clean drinking water or just water scarcity as a whole. So I saw this this headline, an MIT project that created a suitcase-sized water treatment kit that can actually desalinate water. And I mean, it's just super awesome, which desalination, it isn't anything new. It's super costly, very complicated normally. This kit works on less power than a phone charger. It's powered by a $50 solar panel. Like, it's literally the size of a suitcase. And so it's using electrical power to remove the bad particles from water, as opposed to other portable units or units similar to it that are using filters, right? This process is called ion concentration polarization. It actually repels positively and negatively charged particles, so things like salt molecules, bacteria, viruses, and then allows only the clean water to pass through. And, you know, they're doing tests. It's still in development, but they took it to, the Oceanside Beach. It took about 30 minutes to fill a plastic drinking cup with drinkable water. And I just think this is just awesome, right? Like if this idea gets built out further and further, driving the cost down, whatever the cost may be on something like this, this could really bring some dramatic change to the world. This is a huge problem, in many places for many people. And check it out, a suitcase that can turn salt water into drinking water. I think that's awesome.
That is pretty cool. I want it.
You want it just so that you can go to the beach and tell just everybody, like, bloop, 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 bloop. You want some water?
Yeah. Free water. Free water. 30 minutes.
So I think that's pretty neat. Hopefully we'll see kind of a further development of that. My second story of the week. As we know, and as we've heard in recent years, books are being banned in public libraries, primarily because people are worried their children might learn about how the real world works. Half of the books on the list of top 10 banned books of 2021, and this is a list done by the American Library Association, contained LGBTQIA+ content. So that kind of gives you a sense of like why these books are, you know, our kids can't be reading these books. We don't want to let them know how the world works. Well, the Brooklyn Public Library is doing a solid for anyone, and that is anyone ages 13 to 21 in the U.S. If you fall into that category, you can go to their site and you want to look for, what is it called? They're calling it Books Unbanned. So do a search for Books Unbanned. You'll find it. And you can register for a library card and gain access to those titles, the same titles that all the other libraries, you know, that are participating in this book banning thing are banning. And so, nice. Yeah, it's called Books Unbanned. It's a teen-led initiative, which is awesome. And you basically get access to the full ebook collection. So you don't need to find your way, you know, to New York, to the library to actually take advantage of this. Wherever you are in the US, if you're 13 to 21, you sign up for this Books Unbanned, you get your library card and you can check out the ebooks. And I don't know. I just think it's a really great lifeline for kids and young adults to read what they should be able to read, in my own personal opinion. But so I think that's
very cool.
And finally, this one is for audio nerds, which I am one. Apparently, there is a big a new developing physical audio format that's on the horizon. There isn't a whole lot of details here, like actual technical specifications quite yet. So I'm a little skeptical. Producer T-Bone Burnett has announced a new analog disc format called Ionic Originals. And it looks a lot like a record, right? He's holding it right there. It's made of lacquer and aluminum. And the claim is that the sound quality is actually better than sound quality of vinyl, better than the sound quality of digital formats. It's super shiny. It looks really kind of futuristic. It looks both futuristic and retro, right? It's like a combination of both. But he calls it an archival quality format and kind of like the next gen vinyl record. And yeah, like I said, there's not a whole lot of details here, but I'm super interested to figure out or to learn more about this. What he says about analog sound, I totally agree with. He says analog sound has more depth, more harmonic complexity, more resonance, better imaging. Analog has more feel, more character, more touch. Digital sound is frozen while analog sound is alive. And that's like at the core of like what differentiates analog to digital, right? Like digital is a combination of zeros and ones. Analog is truly like it's truly organic. Analog is just an organic quality of things that exist in this real world. And that's one thing that record players have with playing vinyl. Like, sure, it's a recorded sound, but there's a movement, there's an energy to it that just it's a feeling that people who really love vinyl can detect, can pick up on. And so, you know, this kind of plays into that, whether you believe in that thought around audio or not. I personally ascribe to that belief, but I'm curious to see how that pans out. I don't know this is necessarily, I mean, if it's an archival format, I don't know that it's necessarily a format that we're like, you know, lining our shelves with all of those Ionic originals. I think, right. I'm guessing this is more meant to be like a true, like, archival audio format, but interesting nonetheless.
My main concern is the softness of aluminum. Is there not a risk of accidentally damaging the little cuts essentially that create this record?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, even with vinyl, right?
Like, I guess it was the same thing. Yeah, you need to be careful with
it. But I think vinyl was probably softer. Undoubtedly softer. And, you know, you put the needle on the record enough times and that groove flattens out things, the fidelity of the sound in there lessens. And I do wonder if this would suffer, you know, potentially in the long term, the same potential fate. But if it's an archival format, then you store your audio on there and you're probably not playing from it very often. And it's made of aluminum, which is more durable than vinyl. So, you know, maybe it is a step up. I don't know, but curious nonetheless.
Absolutely. Yeah. This is interesting to me. I really love the sound of vinyl. I am one of those people as well. Because I'm not of the mindset that there's some special magical quality to high fidelity audio in general. I just like how vinyl sounds. It has nothing to do with, like, you know, putting on a pair of the best, most expensive headphones I've ever gotten, yada, 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 and hearing 96K kilohertz, whatever, however all that stuff works. I don't care about all of that, but I just plain and simple, I like the way the vinyl sounds.
Yeah. And there's a little bit of a ritual to having a vinyl kind of habit, you know, like playing music and digitally, you literally have access to anything at the touch of, you know, a button or a flick of your finger. And that's awesome. That's so incredible that we have that now and that it's so easy. But when you've got like a record player, a nice sound system, and, you know, probably a catalog of just the records that you care to spend the extra money to own, there's a ritual to it. Like putting that record on, you know, those songs, like, they're not going to be mixed with other songs. It's like, this record is the thing I'm listening to right now. It becomes like a moment instead of just something that's on in the background. And so I don't know how that ties in with this. Maybe this will be the next generation of that, because there has been a resurgence of vinyl in recent years. Collectors have gotten really back into it in a big way, and sales numbers are up with vinyl.
So, I could see some folks, some artists selling for lots and lots of money. You know, three people in the world can buy this version of their record. You know what I mean? Like Taylor Swift sells three of these, and our friend Christina Warren would definitely own one.
Well, Wu-Tang had an album that only one person, and that person ended up being a total scumbag, but personal opinion. I can't remember his name. But anyways, same thing, right? Like we've released one album. Who knows whether it's any good or not, but there's someone out there that's like, oh, it's a Wu-Tang album and it's the only one that exists. I will pay whatever it takes to get that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So that's it.
Oh, no,
that's
it's scarcity all over again.
Yes, totally. Right. Scarcity.
Everything is scarcity.
Exactly. So yeah, that's it. That's what I got.
Very good.
Yes, Tech News Weekly publishes every Thursday at twit.tv/TNW. If you want to subscribe to the show, that's where you got to go. twit.tv/TNW. You find all the ways to subscribe in audio, video formats, and you can jump out to YouTube and subscribe that way as well.
If you would like to get all of our shows ad-free, we've got a way for you to do that. You can check out Club Twit for $7 a month. You get some real good stuff at twit.tv/Club Twit. First, you get, as I mentioned, feeds of all of our shows with no ads. You get access to the members-only Twit Plus bonus feed that has extra content you won't find anywhere else, including later today, a conversation with Scott Wilkinson. That was a great AMA this morning. And you will also get my MAMA with John Ashley, which just took place last Thursday. John Ashley is the editor of this show, the technical director, and a producer here at Twit. And last but not least, you get access to the Discord server, which is a place where you can go and chat with your fellow Club Twit members, but also chat with those of us here at Twit. It's a fun place to hang out with lots of cool folks there. Join it now if that sounds good to you at twit.tv/clubtwit. I should also mention that if you would like to subscribe to individual shows, then you can if you use Apple Podcasts. In Apple Podcasts, you type in Tech News Weekly, you find the audio version of the show, and you tap, you'll see a button to subscribe for $2.99 a month. Doing so gets you the ad-free version of the audio feed. If you want to follow me online, I'm at Micah Sargent on many a social media network, or head to chihuahua.coffee. That's chihuahua.coffee, where I've got links to the places I'm most active online. You can check me out Saturday with Leo Laporte for the Tech Guy podcast, where we talk to people and answer their questions from taking your calls. And also on Tuesdays for iOS Today, which I do with Rosemary Orchard. Jason Howell, where do people go to find you?
Well, right here on twit.tv, I do All About Androids, another show, twit.tv/AAA if you're in the Android world, or even if you're not and you just like hearing people who enjoy being in the Android world talking about it, check out All About Android. Also, I'm going to be doing live coverage of Google's upcoming Google I.O. keynote. So this happens next week, next Wednesday. What is that? May 11th, I believe, at 10 a.m. Pacific. It's going to be me, Leo, and Jeff Jarvis doing nice live coverage of Google I.O.'s keynote. So I'm really looking forward to that. So twit.tv/live, or you find it on the site soon after, you know, we'll have it published there. And yeah, so keeping busy as I can. Also want to thank everybody at the studio for helping us do this show each and every week. Burke, of course, John Ashley, everyone who helps behind the scenes. Thank you. We couldn't do it without you. And thanks to you at home or on transit or in your car, or wherever you happen to be watching and listening. We couldn't do the show without you either. We'll see you next time on Tech News Weekly. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Did you spend a lot of money on your brand new smartphone and then you look at the pictures on Facebook and Instagram and you're like, what in the world happened to that photo? Yes, you have. I know. It happens to all of us. Well, you need to check out my show, Hands-On Photography, where I'm going to walk you through simple tips and tricks that are going to help make you get the most out of your smartphone camera or your DSLR or mirrorless, whatever you have. And those shots are going to look so much better, I promise you. So make sure you're tuning in to twit.tv/hop for Hands-On Photography to find out more.